Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Du Hirsu,
with a musical introduction by Brendan Lowe, our director of music. Thanks for listening.
It comes from the Gospel of Mark. Quite a change from the song that we just read. I feel like I should have one of those NC-17 ratings. Okay, you've been warned. So from chapter 6, verses 14 to 29, King Herod heard of it, for Jesus' name had become known. And some were saying, John the Baptizer has been raised from the dead, and for this reason these powers are at work in him. But others said, it is Elijah. Others said, it is a prophet, like one of the prophets of old. But when Herod heard of it, he said, John, whom I beheaded, has been raised. For Herod himself had sent men who arrested John, bound him, and put him in prison on account of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, because Herod had married her. For John had been telling Herod, it is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. And Herodias had a grudge against him and wanted to kill him. But she could not, for Herod feared John, knowing that he was a righteous and a holy man, and he protected him. When he heard him, he was greatly perplexed, and yet he liked to listen to him. But an opportunity came when Herod, on his birthday, gave a banquet for his courtiers and officers and for the leaders of Galilee. When his daughter, Herodias, came in and danced, she pleased Herod and his guests. And the king said to the girl, ask me for whatever you wish, and I will give it. And he solemnly swore to her, whatever you ask, I will give you even half of my kingdom. She went out and said to her mother, what should I ask for? She replied, the head of John the Baptizer. Immediately, she rushed back to the king and requested, I want you to give me at once the head of John the Baptist on a platter. The king was deeply grieved, yet out of regard for his oaths and for the guests, he did not want to refuse her. Immediately, the king sent a soldier of the guard, and with orders to bring John's head, he went and beheaded him in the prison, brought his head on a platter, and gave it to the girl. Then the girl gave it to her mother. When his disciples heard about it, they came and took his body and laid it in a tomb.
So that was so not intentional, but kind of perfect, actually. Because no matter which translation you use, you just can't make that nice, whether it's the NRSV or the Message. And we've shifted computers because this phenomenal young person who works at Apple gifted the church a brand new iMac. Our other one that had been there for 5 years was on its last, past its last leg. And now we have a new one, but we are still working out some of the kinks. And so that what we saw on the screen was the Message, and what Linda shared was the NRSV, but you just can't make it not what it is, no matter what translation you use. See, I don't think you're ever going to see Mark 6, 14 to 29, etched in eye black on a football field. You're not going to find it on tattoos at CrossFit, and I definitely think you're not going to see it at the co-op on somebody's bumper sticker. See, John 3:16 is made for that kind of stuff. But Mark 6, 14 to 29, this is like Game of Thrones. So glad we do worship twice now, because I get to see that again at 11 o'clock. will never see that show in the same way again after this morning. See, Herod was initially married to the daughter of a king. And then he went and visited his half-brother and fell in love with his half-brother's wife. That's the beginning of where we're heading, Game of Thrones style. But it gets even worse than that, see? As though that's not enough. Herodias, this woman, she is actually the granddaughter of Herod the Great, his dad. So she becomes his wife and she's his niece. And here we have him married to his brother's wife right there in front of us. And you can't, you don't even have to make this up. Like biblical Christianity. Next time somebody tells you that, just think Mark 6. This is way more complicated than anyone wants to recognize. So he throws this huge party where his stepdaughter, niece, grandniece, the daughter of his new wife, she, as you'd always do, she dances for him and for the people that are there. Because that's just normal. Right? That's what happens. And it moves him. We'll just leave it at that. And he's so deeply moved that he says, I'll give you half of everything I've got. Well, he's a king. Like, that's a lot that he's saying. I'll give you half of all of this stuff. So she runs back to her mom, the mom that has set all of this in play, correct? And she says, what should I ask for? So it's almost like that moment where the pimp is there to say, here you go. This is Game of Thrones, people. Stay with me. Stay with me. She wants John's head on a platter, period. And so within a moment, that's exactly what happens. It's exactly what happened. She'd been waiting for this opportunity. See, the king had found something in John and wasn't ready to go there. And this is the Bible's way, the author of Mark's gospel. This is their way of saying winter is coming. So the Game of Thrones people that are with me know what I'm talking about. And if you're not a Game of Thrones person, here's I'm not going to give you a synopsis, believe me. But here's a gist. When something is getting ready to happen that's so foreboding, like evil is coming, evil is on the way, violence, death, destruction is on the way. The phrase for that is winter is coming. And this is the gospel writer's way of saying, folks, winter is coming. The head on the platter. The empire is going to take the head of this prophet and every prophet. Anyone that stands up against it, this is what's going to happen. See, George Martin, the writer of Game of Thrones, he has nothing on Mark's gospel. Like, nothing. This is where it goes. And so, just to pause for a moment. You might remember, Mark's gospel begins not with the story of Jesus' birth. It ends not really with the story of resurrection. It's sparse on details, but somehow in Mark 6, it takes a whole paragraph to tell us exactly what is happening here to John the Baptist. So what in the world could possibly be the good news in this kind of a story that we find in Mark 6? What possibly could we find here that is hopeful? So in part, I want to invite us this morning to look closely at this particular text and then to hold it in tension with the rest of Mark's gospel. And as we do that, one of the first things that we'll notice is this is the only moment in Mark's gospel where Jesus makes no appearance. None. No Jesus in this whole Game of Thrones mess that I've just shared. No Jesus. I don't think that's a coincidence. See, it seems to me that we find in this story the ways of the world. And the ways of the world are often like Game of Thrones or The Wire or whatever it is that you look at to help you realize the mess that you're in. You're not alone in it. The rest of the world is in a similar place. We all have our own messiness, whether it's the political life around us, and way too often it's right inside of our own stories, our own families. See, in all of this, we witness really good intentions that go awry. We witness the triumph of power over the prophetic. We witness fearless truth-telling being rewarded with imprisonment or being shipped off, sent away, and held tight in Russia, whatever the case may be. See, it's back then and it's today as well. Mark is blunt about the realities of the world. the realities of the mess that we find ourselves in back then and right now. And Mark does not spare any details. And so when we hold this in conversation with the rest of the gospel, I believe we have an opportunity to see that Mark's honesty about the brokenness of the world and the brokenness of our own lives, it pales in comparison to this same writer's passion for sending me and you and all the folks around us out to share about and to witness and to tell the story of God's great love for the world. I believe that it's here in this story because it's how our lives too often are. And it's not the whole story. This Game of Thrones mess is true, and it doesn't have the final say. The promise of God's great love for the world is luring us into a future that is otherwise from however we find ourselves at this moment. There's a Lutheran pastor and scholar whose name is David Loos, and he writes about it like this. This is the way of the world, but it's not the whole story. Because Jesus comes, you see, precisely to show us that there is something more, something beyond the heartache, intrigue, and tragedy of Herod. Which brings us, I think, to the very heart of the gospel promise. We believe and teach and confess that Jesus came to make possible for us more than mere survival, more than mere persistence, more even than mere success. Jesus came to help us imagine there is more to life than we can even perceive, and Jesus came to show us and to offer us that more life, that abundant life. There is more to this ending than we can write ourselves or imagine or construct on our own, and that is the good news. That's the gospel. Yet stories like this one, stories like we find in Mark 6, they're kind of the final break for so many people that choose to walk out of a door and say, I am not going to look for God anymore in a religious community. I am going to find myself spirituality on my own. There can be nothing from that mess that could possibly be worth it. They see Herod's head on a platter, and they're going to walk down the street. Brunch at Selin's, a walk around McKinley Park by myself. I'm going to take a little from this or a little from that. There's a pastor whose name is Lillian Daniel, and she's a pastor in the United Church of Christ. She's been writing extensively for these last few years about trying to reclaim religion. Her notion is that spirituality by itself is just not enough for us. And maybe 5 or 6 years ago, Linda and I heard her preach at a conference in Minneapolis. And for me, it was one of those moments where you're sitting there and there's 1,000 people in the room and that person is speaking directly to you at this moment. Because I've been one of those spiritual but not religious people, trying to make it on my own and to figure out how I can pull things together and believing that there could be nothing possible and the people who've gone before us, look at the mess they've created, let's just figure it out on our own. So in the coming weeks, we're going to look together, and we decided to start here with religion because we know in our community that I'm not alone in that. A lot of you all are still kind of holding in tension this whole possibility of being in religious community. Maybe I'll just go the way of spirituality, and that'll be deep, and I can find that on my own, and I'm not sure what to do with all of this other stuff, the people around us. And so we knew if we were going to have a series called On Ramp that's going to address some of the bigger topics in faith, we needed to start with this. Like, why are we even here? So we're starting here this morning. And then next week, we're going to look together at the Bible, and then at God, and at Jesus, and at salvation. Each week, we're going to take on a different topic. And what I hope is to invite all of us gathered in this space to reflect from wherever we find ourselves at this moment on how God might be calling us into the future and what that could be. And it's going to be different for you than it is for me, but we're going to try to live in that together over these next few weeks. Lillian Daniel writes about it like this. The beauty of a long tradition is that it's bigger than anything we can do by ourselves. These days, it's somewhat countercultural to suggest that one might possibly benefit from the company of others in the life of faith, particularly those who've gone before us in faith. I wanted more than just an intellectual epiphany, something with a longer shelf life than my own latest opinion. See, differentiating spirituality and religion from one another is actually tricky in and of itself. I was reminded of that as I was visiting a kitchen table this week, and I want to take a moment to try to unpack that. So spiritual but not religious is this term that's used now to try to understand sociologically how people are practicing their faith and all of the different ways that it looks in our world. Very different now than it did just a few decades ago. And it can be a really helpful descriptor. And yet it seems to me that it encompasses so many different groups of people that it probably just falls apart as a term as well. That tends to happen when we try to say, people are like this. No, they're not, actually. And we're going to use it, though, to try to help us get a lens on it. So one of the groups that gets lumped, I think, inaccurately into spiritual but not religious is actually a group of people that identify as new atheists. So these are folks like Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens. These are folks that think I am absurd, just in and of my being. Probably I'm breathing too much air right now would be the approach of new atheists. They would definitely get thrown into this pile at times, and I think that's a little wrongheaded, because first and foremost, these are folks who are deeply anti-religious. They're anti-religious, and I'm not sure if spirituality ever comes into their framework. See, they believe that nothing good can come from religious community like this or from engaging our religious traditions. And it seems to me that in the name of these liberal ideals, I fear that they actually become fundamentalist caricatures of the things that they despise. So in the name of not being that narrow, it becomes really, really narrow in this world of new atheism, really, really quick. And these men, and I say men intentionally because that are all of the prominent writers in this movement are white men, they dismiss the possibility of finding hope or beauty or love in anything other than the worldview that they have created and written about with one another. A seminary professor and my advisor, Larry Rasmussen, he says it better than I can. The dismissal of religion by its cultured despisers, in any event, is an exercise in futility. It runs against the grain of a species that is incorrigibly religious. And that feels really true to me. And thankfully, the new atheists don't have the final say on what spiritual but not religious is. There's a group that's much more earnest and loving, that thinks about spirituality but is unwilling to move in religious circles. And we find this all around here in Sacramento and throughout Northern California, maybe in the whole world. We're like the epitome of where this exists. Maybe Portland beats us. I don't know. It's probably close. But these are folks who find that religious community is simply too stifling. There's not enough space for them within it. Oftentimes, these are folks who have actually been kicked out of religious community, either in explicit ways, as I know has been the case for some people in this very room, or in ways where the way the religion was set up, there was just no room for them at all. And so on some level, folks are forced to try to figure out their way of being spiritual but not religious. And I think of the people in this room who've been burned and wounded by church in such profound ways that they didn't even think, you all didn't even think, that you could ever be worthy of receiving God's grace or being part of a community that said, God loves you just as you are. See, in the name of the religion, and particularly Christian religion, so many folks have been told that their sexuality or their gender identity, it's not good enough for God. And so they gave up on religion. And I get that. And I think it may be necessary at times in each of our lives to give up on religion, at least certain forms of religion. I know it was for me at various moments in my life. But ultimately, like Lily and Daniel and the writer of the Gospels, I realized that I needed more than myself to find my own way in this world. I needed a community of people in which to root my life in grace and grow in faith and reach in love. I didn't always have the language for it. But I think deep down, I've always known that I needed something like that. And I think it's why we need kitchen tables. I think it's why we need that weekly practice of watching over each other in love. I know in my own life, as I've journeyed with the kitchen table over these years, I know that it's this small tribe of people that has helped sustain me when it feels like winter isn't just coming, but it's all around. And at the same moment, it's been my kitchen table that has helped me to see when winter has passed, but I actually don't have the eyes yet to even be aware that I've made it through to another side. And I know some of your stories. More than a couple of you are more brave than I can imagine for simply walking into worship this morning, for allowing the possibility that being your spiritual self in a religious community may just take you deeper into your relationship with God and your neighbors. Lillian Daniel says, anyone can find God alone on a picturesque mountaintop, a hiking trail, or the sunset. The miracle is that I can find God in the company of others who are just as annoying as I am. And she continues, it's pretty easy to play by the rules of a religion in which you write your own script, much harder to find meaning in the words of a book that we did not write for ourselves from a very different time. And to be clear, that's exactly what the Bible is. We're moved by fear and terror and power and beauty. And the writer of Mark's gospel is very clear that that moves us back then and today. A theologian, Douglas John Holm, writes about it like this. The real theme in reading Mark 6 is not the drama of life and death or love and hate. That easily captivates our imaginations. But the real theme is the confrontation of political power and prophetic faith. That's it, what's at play here. It's this great struggle between the baptizer and the king. It's a complicated tension because so often in the world we want to make one good and one evil, one light and one darkness. But not here, not in this story, not with these two people. And I think that is part of the beauty of what our Christian tradition has to offer, to correct our own tendencies to see good as in here and bad as out there. We're invited in our religious tradition to expose and see paradox and contradiction. It's at the heart of our faith. And for some of us, that gets really complicated to hold those paradoxes and contradictions. And we want easy answers, and so we settle for reducing Christianity to something far less than what it ever was meant to be or was at a time. But our tradition can lead us into something deeper, something more profound. And it's partly this, that evil isn't just out there. It's all too often entangled within my own very being, in spite of my own very best intentions. And it's obvious when you just look at Herod. He's by no means a standard villain, right? See, he recognizes from the very beginning in John the Baptist that there is something in John the Baptist that might be luring him to be the kind of human being he really wants to be. So he wants to say no to Herodias at first. That's his impulse. There is something in this, quote, villain that is deeply good, longing for something more. And we would think that his royal office would allow him the kind of power in which it does not matter what the people around him think. It doesn't matter what they want. He's the king, but clearly we're reminded in this story that whatever someone's positional authority might be, it never secures the kind of power that we might imagine. So just like Paul in Romans 7, Herod might just say these kinds of words also. I find that when I want to do what is good, evil lies close at hand. For I delight in the law of God in my inmost self, but I see in my members another law at war with the law of my mind, making me captive to the law of sin that dwells in my members, wretched man that I am. But we don't do any service to biblical faith if we look then to John the Baptist and just see pure goodness, because it's not there either. Douglas John Haw says it really powerfully to me. Wasn't there some reason both the mother and the daughter were so fatefully drawn to John? Could it not be, as it has so often been with the heroes of morality, that his heroic self-discipline cloaks a passionate libido, rendering him all the more subject to the sin of pride. See, maybe for John the Baptist and maybe for Herod, the world is wrapped up. The mess of Game of Thrones is wrapped up in who they are. And what makes the encounter of the prophet and the king so poignant is that they actually, for moments, understand one another. They see themselves in one another. So this puppet king knows enough to recognize his own falseness in John. And the prophet is sufficiently acquainted with temptation that he does not want the monarch to go there. They see one another in one another, and their meeting could have been redemptive. But there's this one enormous flaw. And I think it's witness to the notion that this is the only place in Mark where Jesus isn't showing up. That flaw is Herod's insatiable quest for preeminence. There's never enough. He wants to have more, keep it, flaunt it. It's this lust for power that is the problem of this text. So what prophetic faith or looking back in a profound way to our Christian religious tradition can teach us above all is the absurdity of our own pretense for sovereignty. It's absurd, and yet we all find ourselves in various ways, I'll say it that way, I find myself in various ways moving toward it. And we're called here to believe that there's an otherwise. See, not the creature, but the creator determines the end that we're moving to. So, friends, it's this power and this beauty, this paradox, this truth that is our Christian religious tradition. And it reminds us back then when the temple's been destroyed, or today when your own marriage is ending, or you lost your job, or you just receive word from that doctor, or you fear that your child is not going to speak to you ever again, or you're pretty sure that your friend has betrayed you, or you think you may just have screwed up the one relationship that really felt like it meant anything to you. The possibility of another ending, a good ending, is indeed not just good news, but it's the very best news that we can imagine. And it's the gospel. It's the good news of Jesus' message that missing in this story, Jesus is coming in the lines that follow. So when the theme song to Game of Thrones starts to play in the recesses of your soul, and it will, maybe not today, but it will, and when that song starts to build toward a deafening rumble, where everywhere around you feels like winter is not just coming, but already here, may we remember the promise. The promise of this old-time Christian religion. That winter doesn't have the final say. An ending more powerful, more hopeful, more loving, and more just than we can imagine. That's what's coming. We call it in our tradition God's kingdom, or God's kingdom. That's what's coming. That's what's always been promised. Thanks be to God and to those who have passed that tradition along to you and to me. Amen.
As the days unfold, hold your breath to see. Life is a mystery. And joy it is severe when the way is rough and steep. But love will make your days complete.